Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. Jay, going through that history was really fascinating to me, and just to show you how much by getting us all together we can begin to build upon this skeleton. You mentioned Hollerith, who developed the first tabulating machine. He developed that in order to do the 1880 census. And in fact, this tabulating machine, the first tabulating machine that was used in state government in Illinois, was at the Illinois Department of Public Health. So all of these things connect, and we can begin to bring all our stories together. So I'm really pleased that you're so involved in this project and wish you all the success, and certainly hope I can help you with that. So I just want to note that this is my disclosure. And different than the one that Jay had, where he said that he had no relationships, and I'm sorry for him because of that, mine just says I have no disclosures. Herophilus said in 300 BC that when health is absent, wisdom cannot reveal itself, art cannot manifest, strength cannot fight, wealth becomes useless, and intelligence cannot be applied. Our approach, our concept of how health is so important in our lives, really threads throughout history. And it's that kind of approach, and since I'm from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, I have to talk just a little bit about the culture of health. Bringing all that together and understanding is what led us to adopt our vision that we as a nation will strive together to build a culture of health, enabling all in our diverse society to lead healthy lives now and for generations to come. And as the backdrop on this story, what does that mean? Well, it means that being healthy and staying healthy is an esteemed social value. That the health of the population guides public and private decision making. Not just government, but public and private decision making. That geography and demographics do not serve as barriers to good health. And this has always been an issue for immigrant communities, where they have suffered some of the worst health outcomes throughout the history of our nation. And that individuals, businesses, and governments work collectively to foster healthy communities and lifestyles. And that the economy is less burdened by excessive and unwarranted healthcare spending. And that we are all supported to make proactive choices that will improve health. This has been always a recurrent theme about the choices that people make. And what's important, and we in public health understand that, is that the choices people make are determined by the choices that they have. And it's very easy from a position of comfort to criticize the choices that others make. But if you live in a food desert, what choices do you have when you choose to make food? And that we will only be able to succeed if we take chances and consider completely new ways of thinking, which brings us back to history. Think about that. We talked a little bit about some of the things of 1900. The leading causes of death then, as Jay pointed out, pneumonia, tuberculosis, and dysentery. Life expectancy was 49 years. And we as a nation spent about 4 to 5% of our gross domestic product on health care. Contrast that with 1960. Leading causes of death were heart disease, cancer, and stroke. And life expectancy had jumped from 49 years to 65 years. Probably one of the single greatest increases in life expectancy since man decided that saber-toothed tigers didn't really make good house pets. And still, in 1960, we only spent 4 to 5% of our gross domestic product on health care. What happened between those 2 years, those two dates? Public health interventions. Better nutrition, better sanitation, and immunizations. When you look at the downturn in tuberculosis, it precedes the discovery of antibiotics to treat it. That basic public health interventions were responsible for this huge increase in life expectancy. And rounding out the 20th century, by 2000, life expectancy had gone up to 75 years, and we were spending 15% of our gross domestic product on, on healthcare. Did we get that return on investment for that huge investment that we are now spending on healthcare? So as we look back upon that century of dramatic progress, it really raises a need to understand that our public health history lays the foundations for public health practice into the future. And that we're able to achieve not because we're changing what we're doing, but because we're building upon that foundation. And it's so critical for us to understand what that foundation is about. So let me use this as to talk about how we build upon that foundation, to talk about two giants in public health epidemiology, and use that to illustrate some of the important components of our approaches to public health. The first is this gentleman, Percival Pott. Percival Pott was certainly a very rounded individual. As a physician, he studied tuberculosis of the spine, which is now called Pott's disease. He studied many fractures. He studied orthopedics. But what he did as an epidemiology is he made the first connection between an occupation and cancer, between chimney sweeps and cancer of the scrotum. And we think about that profession, and many times we think about Mary Poppins when we think about what the life like was for chimney sweeps, many of who were very young boys. This actually is more of a portrayal of what life was really like. These young boys were forced to go down into these flues because they were small enough to do that. Frequently, they would go down without any clothes on so that they wouldn't get trapped in the twists and turns. And their sweat would ingrain the soot from the coal into their scrotum, leading subsequently to scrotal cancer. So he published this work in 1775, truly a major leap of understanding about the interplay between occupation and cancer. Yet when you look at the literature, and this is from an article in 1892, in London they were still lamenting the fact that chimney sweeps were getting scrotal cancer. Now let me contrast that with another giant, John Snow. He is considered the father of modern epidemiology, and I wondered why him and not Percival Pott. Well, as we know the story, there was an outbreak of cholera. He went to drew up a map of the area that was involved because he noticed that people in one community were getting cholera and people in another community weren't. And he had one of the first graphical information systems that were known in this world. It's called a map and a pencil. And he plotted out and he found that, in fact, it all seemed to be centered around this pump at Broad Street. Incidentally, there were some subsequent studies that found that there was a cesspit that had been built. It had been covered over when the house was moved in order to broaden the street, thus the Broad Street. And then when they dug this well, they dug it within 3 feet of that, 3 feet of that cesspit. Thus began the transmission. But John Snow not only looked at the pump, but then he went to the guardians of the St. James Parish where that pump was located. He gave to them the circumstances, and in consequence of what he did, the handle, the pump was removed, and the outbreak ended. Today, at the site of this event, there is a pumpless handle, a handleless pump that sits there on Broad Street, memorializing what he did. But we consider him the father of modern epidemiology because what he did was not only develop the science, create the evidence base, but that wasn't enough. Our public health practice is not only developing the science base, but putting it in action to improve the health of the populations we serve. It was that understanding and that connection between disease and public action that 22 years after John Snow wrote his work led to the formation of the State Department of Public Health here in Illinois. At a meeting of the Medical Society of the State of Illinois, Dr. Gray said, a board of health organized and provided with means to collect information and diffuse among people a better knowledge of the laws of health, and to discover to them, they always use those funny kind of words, to discover to them the dangers to which they're exposed, it would save thousands of poor victims from untimely death. A year later, legislation was passed that created the Illinois State Board of Health. And you heard from John, from Jay about the role of John Rausch, who played a very singular role in public health. I mean, just imagine having the fourth meeting, the meeting of the American Public Health Association in Chicago. How long did it take people to travel to get here? They couldn't fly. Certainly couldn't drive in automobiles. There were no roads. Having a meeting was really a tremendous event, but it was necessary to bring together those who were the leaders in the field. And certainly that was a singular accomplishment. It was these kinds of outbreaks of disease that had big impacts and led to the development of the Chicago Board of Health, which predated the Illinois Department of Public Health. But looking at the history, I think there are some very important lessons to learn. When you go through the history of Chicago and look at the disease and the book that Linda referred to, which is The Rise and Fall of Disease in Illinois, which was published in 1926, subsequent copies of sequels to that came out, carried that history all the way up to 1975. And what I did was have it reprinted because there were only one or two copies left, so that it would be available to libraries across the country so others could understand the history of public health in the state. In 1832, there was an outbreak of cholera in Chicago, and the first sanitary ordinance was written. In 1834, they developed a temporary board of health and a cholera vigilance committee. In 1835, they created the Chicago Board of Health. And all was right in the world, right? So 1835 to 55, there were periodic outbreaks of cholera, smallpox, typhoid. That was pretty much the way people lived in that time. Because of this was before germ theory, this was before the work of Dr. Snow, this was before we understood how important sanitation was. I'm always curious about that why we didn't know so much about sanitation, given that, you know, over 4,000 years ago in the Indus Valley, they had flushing toilets in many of the communities there, that this was considered to be one of the highlights, I think, probably the most important public health invention was to realize that if you keep sewage away from your drinking water, you actually were healthier. But still, we had to learn that lesson over and over again. Now, one of the fascinating things about the city of Chicago is if you go into some of the really old neighborhoods, you find that you have to go down to go into the front door. And that was because they raised the whole level of the city about 10 feet for sanitation reasons to aid in the drainage. They completed that around the 1860s, so they felt that they could just abolish the Board of Health. This is a true fact. In the 1860s, they continued to have outbreaks of cholera and smallpox, and the current iteration of the Chicago Board of Health was created. So looking at this history, it brings me to my treatise for this presentation. And that is that public health can grow in a crisis. In fact, frequently that's the only time public health grows. That when public health does its job right, nothing happens. When you do your intervention, kids don't get measles when you get all the kids immunized. When you have safe drinking water, people don't get cholera. When you are engaged in building community so people have healthy choices in food, then you control chronic diseases. So when public health does its job right, nothing happens. But when nothing happens, public health is cut. That is our litany. So let me talk about a few examples that led me to understand this. As I mentioned, from ancient times, diseases have had a major impact upon our society and understanding. In fact, it was the immortal words of Hippocrates who talked about how to respond to outbreaks of disease. Now, like many of the individuals of this time, We know most of what they wrote in Latin because the Greek was translated. But basically, to translate this, it means if you find an outbreak of disease, leave quickly, go far away, and come back slowly. But crisis can drive change. Let me give an example. In the 1990s, as director of the State Health Department, I could never get our budget significantly increased to fight infectious diseases. So I would go to the budget hearing, and every time I would go, and you know, I would come in after the Department of Mental Health or the Department of Human Services or whatever department, and they would have like 100 advocates in the room. And I'd come up for my hearing, and it would empty out, and it was like me and a couple of my senior staff. And I would go to this hearing, and I would make an argument about how we need to increase funding in public health. And the next year, I came in with some charts and graphs, and I talked about how prevention works. Still, our budget didn't go up. And then I would go in, and I would say, you know, let's look about, you know, just look at programs like immunizations. If you were to take us back to 1900, and we had children dying at the same rate due to communicable diseases that are preventable by vaccines, 1,400 kids would die this year. But they didn't. Still, I didn't get funded. In 1999, there was an outbreak of invasive group A strep in Decatur, Illinois. Despite the fact I had been asking for upgrade in our laboratory to be able to do molecular biology and to have a public health infectious disease response team, and never been funded. So I went to the Bureau of the Budget after this outbreak, because it was, you know, it got a lot of news, and I said, what we need is the improvements in our laboratory, and we needed to get an infectious disease response team. I have to admit to all of you, my friends, and I think the statute of limitations may have passed, that there was no relationship between any of these things and this outbreak, which was mostly in the nursing home. I knew that, but they didn't. And within a few months, we had funding for both the response team and the molecular biology laboratory. And that was a good thing. And that was a good thing. Because just a few months later, there was an event called Cornstalk, which was a group of individuals who had a band. They would play at fairly seedy places in St. Louis and in downstate Illinois. So they wanted to have an event once a year so their families could listen to them play. And this event grew bigger and bigger as their friends invited their friends. And they held it out in a cow pasture. Now, the cows in that pasture, the farmer who was the sponsor of that, gave up one of the cows to provide the meat, and it went to what's called a private slaughterhouse. So these are not regulated. The cow was slaughtered, was roasted in these huge roasters. No one supervised whether or not the meat was well done, and they all cut it up in the same place. Hundreds of people got E. coli 0157H7. But because we had that molecular biology lab, we were able to measure the samples from the patients, food that people had left over, they had taken home with them, their stool samples, the cow pasture cow patties, if you know what I mean, and from the cows themselves, and made a link to understand where that outbreak was and how it came. It provided the capacity for us to be prepared, so that next time we could respond. And I need to hurry on. So it allowed us to be prepared to respond when we had anthrax, and everyone who found white powder began to turn them into the state health departments. And our ability not to respond in the upper left as a laboratory that we had, but in fact a modern laboratory that could use molecular biology in order to identify outbreaks. So let me talk just a little bit about some of my viewpoints and how our history ties into that, and then I'll close. I believe that it's the highest calling for a state public health agency is to create the conditions in which local public health can be successful. But that in trying to address the future, that the difference between a dream and a goal is having a plan. In Illinois, that plan in 1990 was called the Illinois Public Health Roadmap. Now, this map is circa right 1990. The white areas, including this one, which is Madison County, are all counties that did not have a local health department. And as part of that roadmap, I lost the slide. Oh, there it is. As part of that roadmap, the Illinois Public Health Administrators, Association of Public Health Administrators, Association of Local Boards of Health, the Illinois Public Health Association, the State Health Department got together and talked about what were the roles of the state and the local health departments. And at that meeting, the local health administrator said, you know, the Illinois Department of Public Health inspects restaurants and water wells in all those counties where they're uncovered. And as long as you continue to do that, the county boards will never pass an ordinance requiring there to be a Board of Health. I said, okay, that makes sense. So I ended state coverage of those counties. We stopped doing inspections. If you stopped in one of those counties and ate at a restaurant, you were eating in a restaurant that was uninspected. The sad part was is no one complained. I thought I was going to get in a lot of trouble, but no one complained. And then came 1993 in the Great Mississippi Flood. And the town of Alton lost their water supply. We, as the state health department, did set up. We rented milk trucks that were empty and clean. We brought in water. We set up distribution points. And we provided and helped provide the people of Alton to get the water that they need. Well, here's where I thought I was going to be in trouble. Because I was sure that they were going to say, why don't you guys come and inspect our restaurants? But what the county board, and this was a very conservative board, said, help us hire a sanitarian so that we can inspect and open the restaurants. And next year, Madison County, the largest county without a local health department, enacted ordinances to create a local health department. And following through on that policy, there are now only two counties in the state without a local health department. That sometimes you have to make those hard decisions. Moving to the conclusion, we cannot solve, as Albert Einstein said, problems by using the same kind of thinking that we use when we created them. That we have to understand the dynamics of public health systems. That public health can grow in a crisis. That when public health does its job right, nothing happens. And when nothing happens, public health is cut. So, following in the words of Oliver Cromwell, we in public health have to not only strike while the iron is hot, but what history teaches us is that we can also make it hot by striking. And we do that with things like public health accreditation, where a county or a state can compare the standards to what they're doing and say, hey, we have a deficit here. Or things like the county health rankings, which say if our county's in the lower half, maybe we need to rethink our public health priorities. Or reports like the Trust for America's Health, where the reports of state of obesity or ready or not highlight the performance of the public health system. We should not fear those kinds of assessments of our abilities of the public health system, but rather we should embrace them as an opportunity, because it's a way to have a crisis without a crisis. George Santayana has been often misquoted, but he said, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. This project, this history project, is so critical for us to learn the past and learn how much in the ways that we continue to build and revamp our public health movement, but also tying into the words of Einstein, that we not only have to rebuild our movement, we have to strengthen our movement, but we also have to recognize that we have to work differently. We have to think differently. And that means by embracing other sectors that we haven't worked with before. And I think if we can do that, we can not only build upon a strong foundation of public health, but we can build a house of health for our country that will be lasting now and for generations to come. Thank you.
Okay.
I can just do...
Okay, great. So history is around us every day. My youngest grandchild tells me she sees dead people. I'm not sure that that's what I mean by that, but but the difference between memory and storytelling in a bar and history is important to understand. History is what allows you to realize that Brother Pot, I got to defend Pot, you know, I'm an occupational health person. The reason Percival Pot didn't make progress in the United Kingdom is because they didn't have a public health approach. In the Scandinavian countries, they passed a law that said chimney sweeps, if you employ a chimney sweep, they must be provided with two changes of clothes, like about the time period, that was a big deal. And they must be allowed to wash up after they clean your chimney in your house. But now, in Britain, they didn't want no little poor children in their house cleaning up, and they didn't want to give them no clothes, so they continued to have scrotal cancer. History puts context into our stories in public health and into the people that act on them. And so I love Ted because he's the only professional. I think he may be the only one in the room, but I know he's the only professional historian at this table, and you wouldn't go to me to do brain surgery. So there's a certain thing that we have to understand and respect about history as a discipline. Amy Fairchild, another important public health historian, explained to me one day, she said, Linda, the history of public health is a history of the arguments that we have as a society. That's what the history of public health is. Professor Brown comes to us as a real trained historian. He's done remarkable work in the field of the history of medicine and the history of public health. He's the author of a fascinating book about Henry Sigeris, another good medical historian you should know about. He co-edited relatively recently a book called Comrades in Health. It looks at American health workers in an international perspective, those people that do international health work. For those of you that don't know or fail to remember, he's one of our official, I don't know if he's official, but he's one of my official APHA historians. I don't know what his status is. He often writes in the journal about public health history, and he's going to come and bring some order to our ramblings up here and help us get a better grasp on how we really need to use history as we go forward. Ted.
Before I move to the lectern, let me ask if those in the back can hear me.
But you know, we need to record.
Oh, okay. So mine isn't as good at the lecture. Notes on yellow paper to read.
So let me try to get my lighting range here. The presentations by Jay Glasser and John Lumpkin serve as wonderful examples of the excitement and importance of public health history. We have become acquainted with past and continuing struggles for public health and learn about those who took the lead, the obstacles they faced, and sometimes the successes they enjoyed. As John Lumpkin has reminded us by quoting George Santayana, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. But as Linda has told you, as someone who earns his living as a professional historian, I'd like to suggest a few ways in which their historical explorations can be pushed a bit further to make them even more useful for those of us in the present who want to learn from them. Let me turn first to Jay Glass's presentation. He called it a flyover, and I agree that it's a great overview at about 30,000 feet. We get a great sense of struggle, of courage, of heroism, but also a blur of problems and reformers, of successes and defeats, and of allies, enemies, and sometimes mysterious political processes. I think we really need to come down from 30,000 feet to ground level and to inspect the terrain at our feet in order to use our history most effectively and to find our best way forward. Let me take just two examples from Jay's remarks. He introduces us to Herman Bundesen, who apparently had a stormy reign as Chicago's health commissioner in the 1920s. Bundesen introduced controversial measures such as setting up free venereal disease clinics and distributing condoms widely, also free. He didn't play ball in the political process, and so he was fired. But he was also undermined as much or more, I think, by the medical profession as by politicians. He was attacked regularly in the Illinois Medical Journal, which called his programs outrageous and unlicensed exercises of power. And I suspect that the journal targeted his infant welfare program as often, or maybe even more often, than his venereal disease program. After all, his great success in reducing Chicago's infant mortality came in the 1920s, just as the National AMA, headquartered in Chicago, may I remind you, and its state and county affiliates waged an all-out war on the Shepherdtown and Maternal and Child Health Act of 1921, and finally got it defunded and defeated and repealed by 1929 because of its horrible intrusion of state, in their terms, that is, socialized medicine into private practice. This was certainly not the only instance of the bitter opposition between private practice medicine and public health, and we really need to know more about it to be fully grounded in our historical explorations. Let me take another example. This from the late 19th century in the area of tenement house reform, sanitary inspection, and immigrant health. I strongly recommend for close reading an article by Margaret Garb, who is now a professor of history at Washington University in St. Louis. It was an article that Liz Fee and I, as editors of the section Public Health Then and Now of the American Journal of Public Health, shepherded through to publication in 2003. Her article focuses on the efforts of Oscar C. DeWolf, who served as Chicago's health commissioner from 1876 to 1889. Garb points out that DeWolf had a broad agenda. He wanted to reform the notorious meat slaughtering and meatpacking industry. Ditto working conditions in factories that destroyed the health of men, women, and children. And also the horrifically unsanitary conditions in Chicago's tenements that contributed significantly to the spread of dangerous contagious diseases. Garb makes a very persuasive case that DeWolf got nowhere in reforming the meatpacking industry or improving the working conditions of men, women, and children in the factories because of the strong and highly effective opposition of the vested interests, and you know which I mean. But he made great strides, made great headway with sanitary inspection in the tenements by shifting the focus from the landlords who really created the tenement house problem and the disease infestation in them to the immigrants who lived and died in those tenements. Let me quote just briefly from what Garb wrote in that 2003 article. DeWolf reports, she wrote, attributed the most intractable tenement conditions to immigrant families. In DeWolf's view, the national origin of the occupants determined the sanitary conditions of the tenement dwellings. DeWolf blamed the inferior quality of the tenement occupants by tenements occupied by Italians, Polish, and Bohemian immigrants as a mix of custom and biology. He wrote, quote, "There are a great many old buildings in this city which are unfit for habitation by civilized people, and yet they are inhabited generally by Italians, Poles, Bohemians, and others who, in their transatlantic homes in the old countries, have been accustomed to live in these crowded and filthy conditions. DeWolf added that it was difficult to enforce tenement ordinances against such habitual and hereditary insanitary modes of living. There, the shift in focus from the tenement owners to the tenement dwellers, and I think it's a very significant and recurrent shift. With their new authority, sanitary inspectors were given the same powers as the regular police, plus the additional power to enter any tenement dwelling without a search warrant between sunrise and sunset. And in addition, the authority to forcibly remove those suffering from smallpox to the city's smallpox quarantine hospital. I don't think you could say that in this instance, public health was immigrant friendly, but was rather empowered by political elites to act as their agent to protect the good citizens of Chicago from the filthy, disease-ridden immigrant horde. We need to study this history too, on the ground, if we are to make it most instructive and useful to us in the present to guide our next steps. Now let me turn to John Lumpkin's enthusiastic use of history. Dr. Lumpkin quite wonderfully identifies what I would call the catch-22 of public health. When it works as it should, it becomes invisible. And when it begins to lose, and then begins to lose support. Loss of support leads to insufficiency of funding, or even to major cutbacks. And this can lead to insurgent or resurgent public health problems because of the decayed and neglected public health infrastructure. Public health is blamed for not protecting the public against the latest public health crisis. This might lead to a burst of interest and an infusion of budgetary support, but then by catch-22, the long-term cycle repeats and repeats and continues. He seems to imply that if we want to support public health more effectively, we need to focus on crises, or at least to take advantage of them strategically. Every crisis is a potential opportunity, and it should be seized upon. I got a good glimpse of that strategy in action by the leadership, or at least part of the leadership of the public health community, as represented by the CDC, in late 2001, in the wake of the anthrax scare to which Dr. Lumpkin referred. The journal Health Affairs, which I'm sure you all know, was considering a special issue on public health policy. I think it's first ever. Policy was usually defined by Health Affairs in different terms, about health economics and other such. And it scheduled the journal editors a high-level meeting in its editorial offices on DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C. Leaders of CDC were there, along with several Washington insiders. And Liz Fee and I were invited to attend as public health historians, probably because of our role as editors of the history sections of the American Journal of Public Health, but also probably because it turned out that in May 2001, we had published an article in AJPH of our own composition, trying to put bioterrorism and biopreparedness into historical perspective, going back to the CDC's efforts during the height of the Cold War anxiety and paranoia in the 1950s that led to the creation of the Epidemiological Intelligence Service, the EIS, that the CDC then rode very effectively to substantially greater prominence and budgetary support. At that meeting on DuPont Circle, there was considerable emphasis on the need to use the crisis in the anthrax context. We were in December, and the crisis had occurred in October, November. It was still with us in December. To use that crisis to greatly increase funding for public health, to build up the infrastructure, and to add capacity for surveillance and biopreparedness. How else to regain the ground that had been lost during the 80s, in the Reagan years? that had led to a major Institute of Medicine report lamenting the poor state of the nation's public health. Focusing on bioterrorism preparedness in the 1990s during the Clinton administration and turning attention to newly emerging diseases like Ebola had helped restore some budget, at least for the CDC, and to regrow some of the national public health infrastructure. But the CDC and its allies understood that the anthrax scare presented a tremendous new opportunity that should be seized and fully exploited to build up, or at least build back, the public health infrastructure. What did Liz and I think? People around the table wanted to know. How might we, as historians, contribute to the special issue of health affairs that would promote this agenda? And as you might have guessed from the tone of my remarks, as historians, we were a bit skeptical and certainly unwilling to become unreflective cheerleaders for a crisis-oriented public health. We mulled over our options and came up with a suggestion that we would write an overview paper on the long-term history of public health in America, but one that expressed some hesitation and maybe even a little skepticism about mobilizing public health around the response to crisis. Our paper was published in that special issue of Health Affairs. It was November 2002. We called it, and our title says a lot, The Unfulfilled Promise of Public Health, Deja Vu All Over Again, quoting Yogi Berra, of course. This was our abstract, and I quote, Many complain about public health's weak infrastructure and poor capacity to respond to threats of bioterrorism. Such complaints are but the anxiety-heightened expression of a periodic rediscovery of the deficiencies and unfulfilled promise of U.S. public health. An overview of more than two centuries suggests that where we are now in public health has been shaped by our earlier, limited, and crisis-focused responses to changing disease threats. End of abstract. Our basic purpose was to highlight what we had come to regard as a long-standing tension within U.S. public health between a pull towards crisis response and preparedness on the one hand and a pull towards social justice, serving the poor, vulnerable, and neglected on the other. You might consider the tension in Chicago terms as between mobilizing public health under Oscar DeWolf to protect the better sort against the disease threat of the tenements, teeming with poor and dirty immigrants, that is, mobilizing social or, as opposed to another Chicago formulation, the social justice formulation, thinking a decade forward and mobilizing reform efforts under Jane Addams, Alice Hamilton, and others at Hull House, and making these reform efforts the essence and focus of a social justice-driven public health. Preparedness and crisis response can generate the political support and the budget that public health needs to survive. And the social justice approach, making the needs of the most vulnerable the first priority, runs the risk of offending elites and power brokers, thus leading to the underfunding and even defunding of public health. Liz Fee and I wanted to raise these difficult questions in 2002 when it would have been easy to jump on the bandwagon and ride the anthrax scare to expand its support for public health. We've learned since that newly allocated biopreparedness funds, which did become available, helped the overall budgets of local health departments, but often, as we've learned, at the expense of ongoing STD and HIV/AIDS programs, sometimes draining them of budget and often of personnel who got shifted over into biopreparedness. I'm not so sure that those issues have been resolved and that a proper balance has been restored. So I, for one, want to say that the strategic use of crisis to support public health may come with considerable and subtle risks, along with obvious advantages. History has its uses, even if its explorations don't always reinforce our current priorities. Thank you.
So I think what Professor Brown reminds us is that history is a science, and we have to consider all of it in its full spectrum, both the good and the bad, the mistakes, as well as the accomplishments. Let me ask if there are questions or comments from the audience here in any way. No questions or comments? Yes.
Okay. There's one of the things that clearly emerged out of the last two presentations is a tension between thinking of building a stable base of support of public health around a broad vision of the mission and using opportunities and crises to help educate and build support. Looking forward from the historian's perspective, how do we reconcile these? What's needed to build the stable base of public health? And what's the appropriate use of crisis?
So as someone considers coming up here, let me just repeat for the tape. This is really a question about how do we balance this tension between being able to act in an opportunistic way around a crisis that happens versus having a stable foundation for public health infrastructure.
So I think our real challenge at public health is to avoid the tyranny of OR, O-R. That building public health is not all let's respond to the next crisis. And that's why I referred to my slide that said the difference between a dream and a goal is a plan. That public health needs to understand what the priorities are. And that was really a challenge that occurred in 2001. There were some agencies that had the concept of dual use. In other words, yes, let's respond to the crisis, but each thing that's adopted should have some sort of current utility. And so you look at what your priorities are, and those priorities are based upon an understanding of basic public health activities related to protecting the air that we breathe, the water that we drink, the food that we eat, the communities that we live, all the things that Hippocrates talked about in air, waters, and places. And at the same time, use individual crises as an opportunity to move that agenda forward. However, just responding to crisis without an agenda frequently leads to waste of resources and transfer of resources from very important programs because you haven't set those priorities. So I think the answer is not either or, but yes and.
Just a brief addendum. I agree that it should not be either or, but both and. And I see as my mission to restore when there seems to be a march in one direction, the alternatives. And it's been my experience in recent years and watching the public health literature, going to meetings, that there's been a great surge of interest in biopreparedness and everything that goes with it. And so I see as my role as a historian, let's return that social justice, that protection and care for the most vulnerable as part of public health's mission, to right the balance, to get both in the scale. And just another very specific comment, a lot of the argument that the CDC folks made at that meeting on DuPont Circle in 2001 was dual use. Put in funding for biopreparedness and we will use those funds in a fungible way for some other purposes. There have been empirical studies in the literature which show that in fact that did not happen. That's the rhetoric. It may have worked in some cases, but in many cases, the hard facts were that those new monies replaced old monies and old programs, and those old programs withered away. And in fact, in the worst case scenarios, which happened in a number of locations, the folks who had been working in venereal disease, STD control, HIV, AIDS, had to be put into staff the biopreparedness programs and forget the other programs they were doing. That's not a proper balance. That was an actual result of a new direction in, I think, an overly enthusiastic way.
Yes.
I would only add, Bob, to what Ted has said, that I think that lack of balance and the distortion of those parties really were exemplified then by the subsequent smallpox campaign. The campaign to inoculate 500,000 armed forces personnel, which did take place, equally to inoculate 500,000 health workers, which failed because of the resistance of health workers to be inoculated. So 38,000 were, because of what people saw as real dangerous uses in that case of that vaccine, which could have morbidity and mortality. And the fact that even the CIA recognized in 2002 that inoculating people against smallpox was really something to really prepare us for going to war in Iraq, in case Saddam Hussein had smallpox to use, which he didn't.
The comment is pointing out the irony when you have the White House writing public health policy in the effort to inoculate hundreds of thousands of Americans about smallpox. Other comments or questions? Yes.
Yeah, just on that point of 2002 and 2003, I don't care what your country managers tell us at the CDC at the time. And clearly the 2001 money floated, that rising tide floated a lot of public health votes that were otherwise going to be marooned in the early 2000 and 2002 had not 9/11 occurred. And this gentleman makes a valid point that in 2003, with that smallpox emergency vaccination fund, the local health directors were saying, where do we get the money to do this? And they were told by the administration, you take that out of the prevention block grant and then go on. I just like to give John kudos. In 2007, we also had a crisis that we didn't take advantage of. The economic stimulus bill was an economic issue. And our good cousins in transportation were ready. They came up with a soundbite, shovel-ready projects. And that money flowed out into transportation and infrastructure and public health to get a lot out of it. I think, John, your point about striking the iron to make it is a separate matter of looking at FAB accreditation and looking at county health rankings and looking at obesity industries. That's pointing the light on the equity, which is the other side of the study. I think you make a very strong point.
Other, yes.
I wanted to get what the speaker thought about the Ebola incident as far as our leadership. At that time, we were trying to use that crisis to get Vivek really appointed as the Surgeon General, because we felt like a rudderless ship, that the populace was very fearful and that it would be nice to have someone other than Sanjay Gupta trying to explain public health to people. So I'm just wondering if the presenter could put that into context as far as the significant discussion.
Maybe I can. Let me make this observation. When you're poor and you don't have enough money to pay the light bill and the gas bill or your rent or buy food, and there's a crisis and somebody gives you a basket of food, you still can't pay the rent and the light, okay? So some of this issue, I'm not against trying to frame issues carefully or being opportunistic or trying to be clever, but the real problem is our lack of public health infrastructure or the lack of a Surgeon General that we could get through those idiots in Congress. It's not the result of a failure to be clever or a failure to frame the issue correctly or to have the right marketing approach. It's a failure of this country to value things that improve the health of the public. And a tendency, as Ted talked about, the wolf, to blame people for the conditions instead of looking at changing the conditions and who benefits from it. So I think the challenge for public health infrastructure is that our infrastructure is crumbling. And all that great thing, I mean, our health state health labs are in horrible shape now. You know, so you do this once because there's a crisis and you can trick them into doing something. You know, 15, 20 years later, you're still in the same boat. So we have to really make a distinction between a long-term issue of how we, where we put our values in society, that determines where we put our investments. Other comments or questions? I saw other hands. Yes, in the yes, come on up. In the second row, that will be next.
And just to follow up one other point on Linda's point is that the importance of leadership. That was the issue with Vivek. That was the issue in 2002. There was the general election in 2003 or 2002, which led to, I think at that time, 36 health agencies lost their directors at the state level. And the group of leadership that said, okay, I understand what the priorities are, and with this bioterrorism money, I'm going to use it to fill in that gap, all left their jobs. I was one of them. And the people who came back in said, oh, the priority is bioterrorism. That is one of the hazards of using crisis, is that if you don't have the leadership who understands the importance of equity, of social justice, but come into their position not having had training and experience, as we see frequently happens at the state level, those priorities cannot be appropriately balanced. And what's missing there, and I made this as a comment, and this is a challenge to all of you, of the many times that I went into an appropriation hearing by myself, if, in fact, we as a public health movement not only support the leadership, but also help them stay on the straight and narrow, help them understand what the priorities are, and speak to the legislature with them, then we can assure that these very important issues are addressed and remain the priorities. But as long as we have state leadership who go to city councils or to the state legislative bodies, and they're the only ones there, they have no support. And so our movement needs to become a movement. It needs to be a public health movement that actually says these are what's important for the health moving forward. And I'll just tie this in just a little bit to the issue of the culture of health, because this is where it becomes so crucial. We have to define health as a common shared value. Our nation, individuals value their health, but as a nation, we don't. And the best way to do that is to follow the money. And if we as a nation can make health a shared value, then our priorities begin to change.
In the second row, I think we have time for one more comment. In the second row. So the questioner, as Ted comes up, is asking, how can you make things that really ought to be a crisis, In other words, things that we find perfectly acceptable that we should find unacceptable. What does history have to tell us about that?
I think what history and what present reality tells us is that intellectuals and academics and analysts can do a whole lot of things and identify a whole lot of problems and publish a whole lot of papers and put up a whole lot of websites and not make a damn bit of difference. What you need is to link that knowledge with social movements. And that's what makes, and in every case that you mentioned, whether it be infant mortality, that became a critical issue because there was a movement supporting the rights and needs of children and social organizations that promoted that. And take every other issue. If there is a community-based or set of community-based movements, instead of professionals arrogantly distancing themselves from it, join with it, be part of it, glory in it, because that's the basis for change, is the way I would put it.